Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy.
Welcome everybody to Our Thoughts Tonight. Today I'm just doing a analysis of the Republican debate of 2023, the first one. My co-hosts aren't here with me today, so it'll just be a shorter episode. I just have some thoughts on, as we all do, on the debate. But I think there's some interesting, revelations about some of these candidates that I haven't really been seeing online as much. I mean, obviously there's some common opinions, but I think there's some underlying, probably more dangerous connotations than people are realizing. So I kind of want to start off, the way I'm going to do this is I kind of want to go basically the worst candidate performance to the best. And honestly, they're not, and like very few of them are anywhere near the top. Overall, I give the whole debate a 6 out of 10. It's very, it was very bland. If we remember the debates, obviously in 2016, and even the Democratic debates in 2020, this was nowhere in comparison, I think, even in entertainment or enjoyment, really. Obviously, back in 2016, you know, there were a whole cornucopia of candidates that were, that were batshit insane. And obviously, I think that's, unfortunately, what makes Republican debates so good, honestly. Really, any debate, unfortunately, but especially for Republican debates. And that's why Trump really won 2016. Although I do believe there was a debate that he did skip out on, which I remember feeling like at the time it was a breath of fresh air, like, you know, going through the debates and here was one that Trump wasn't in. And it was kind of an interesting dynamic. Obviously, in the Democratic debates in 2020, there were some, obviously, hidden moments also in 2016 too, when it was pretty much just Bernie and Hillary. But yeah, especially in 2020, Bernie had his moments, Warren had her moments, Kamala Harris got, fucking destroyed, Joe Biden got piled on in some of the earlier debates. But for this one, it just felt really mediocre, and a lot of people have been making this point, and I think correctly so. This wasn't a debate for president or Republican nominee. It was a debate for VP, at least for the majority of the candidates. I think people like DeSantis and Christie definitely aren't there, for VP positions. I think you could say that DeSantis could have been a VP, but Trump hated his guts before he even started running, which is insane. And obviously, Christie is there as as campaign's a suicide mission. Basically, he's not vying for, VP or the actual nominee position, but just to really spite Trump, obviously. Let's go through the actual candidates. So lowest I have is Asa Hutchinson. Obviously, I gave him a 3 out of 10. Obviously, he was kind of booed in the beginning, but also, I obviously commend him for being anti-Trump, but I think everyone pretty much noticed he's, unnoticeable. I don't know if anybody watched the Trump Tucker Carlson interview. I only watched some clips, but Trump kind of was calling him Ada Hutchinson, and it's obviously childish. He's kind of calling him, feminine or whatever. And I think he blocked some sort of transphobic bill in Arkansas. I don't know the details, but it's which is kind of surprising for a guy from Arkansas. But obviously unnoticeable. Anything good to say about him is irrelevant. He's nowhere. I don't know why he's. That's the one thing I've never understood. Candidates in presidential elections with no chance, and they keep, they still run, and they keep running. Like, I get the suicide mission campaigns. I get VP runnings. I get actual shots at the presidency. I even get people that are like polling, even at like 2%, and I get it. They're low, but they have a part to play. But if you're at like 2.0 or something. I don't even know what it's good for. Not even the name recognition. Like, you're not even getting really decent name recognition. And it kind of goes on to the next guy, you know, Doug Burgum. You know, I gave him a 4 out of 10. Irrelevant, obviously. His launch video had like a couple thousand views, like 7 point something. It's nothing. Like Asa Hutchinson, I guess he's like, you know, has some minor name recognition, like extremely minor, but yeah, you're not getting that with Doug Burgum. In terms of Asa and Doug Burgum's performances, again, I think Asa was, I feel like he barely talked. You know, it was cool that he was there as a semi anti Trump candidate. You could tell that he was kind of willing to speak out his mind. I know when they announced, when they asked the climate change question, you know, who here believes in climate change? It's very quick, but you can actually notice him starting to raise his hand. I don't think he actually got to speak at that point. I don't exactly remember, but you could tell he was kind of taking, you know, I think a little bit seriously. Obviously, when they said, you know, would you pardon Trump, he didn't raise his hand. So, I mean, he has his opinions. He's opinionated. Cool. Performance-wise, again, he wasn't really even there. And with Doug Burgum, kind of. I think Doug Burgum, actually, to be honest, although I gave him a 4 out of 10, because I thought, like, his answers, I think, got some more applause than Asa Hutchinson's. But he was super awkward in answering his questions. There was one moment where I feel like he was just stumbling. They probably had a couple of moments, and yeah, it's irrelevant. I have really no further analysis on those guys. Next, I have, I guess, equal with Doug Burgum is Tim Scott. I was thinking of putting Tim Scott at like 4.5 out of 10. He got some cheers. He's, you know, pretty much the Fox News implanted candidate. Again, I would love to give some of these guys, you know, more analysis, but they really are irrelevant. Tim Scott is, you know, I mean, like, obviously he had that transphobic comment at his closing speech. He had, you know, he's obviously, you know, pro-life. I think he said he supported the government wide. Actually, yeah, no, he did support a national abortion ban. So, I mean, obviously horrendous politician. You could say he's kind of, I guess, you know, just a typical Republican. So, charisma-wise, I think, like, again, like, the charisma's there, but it's like, you know, 1992 charisma. You know, it's just, you know, this is not where we're at right now. And I honestly, in terms of that kind of charisma, only a few of the candidates really got that. You know, basically, are you like Trump? Are you aggressive like Trump? And Tim Scott obviously wasn't there for that. Then I think we get to the actual serious candidates, kind of. Next I have is Ron DeSantis, and this is where I pretty much start my, I guess, semi philosophical analysis. I gave him a 5 out of 10, and I mean, DeSantis' campaign has been like absolutely horrendous, obviously. You know, and I was actually, honestly, I'm a little bit split on his performance for the debates. Obviously, you know, a lot of people have been, I was looking at some Republican opinions as well, or I should say conservative. And I think it's a pretty unanimous consensus that he just didn't do well. I was kind of split because, I don't know, he was kind of out of his own world. You know, obviously because of his name and, you know, who he is, he had more presence than, like, obviously, like, someone like Asa, Doug, or Tim Scott. But I think similar to them, he was kind of in his own world. He engaged, obviously, but he really, I don't know, he was pivoting hard. He pivoted, I mean, for the whole Mike Pence thing, like, he, you know, that question of, like, oh, did Mike Pence do the right thing? He pivoted hard on that. You know, he just, and also with climate change, you know, like, they asked a question. I mean, honestly, I was really proud of, you know, low-key proud of Fox News for actually asking, as, like, a show of hands, who will do this? And he, like, jumped in and was like, we're not doing that. Like, he kind of, you know, kind of saved the rest of the group, you could say. But he really, again, he was just dodging. And then, but the real, and so, I guess it was like a political maneuver that's, I don't want to say impressive, but, like, okay, I get what you're trying to do. Obviously, it comes off as super disingenuous and not, you know, and he didn't do it in a way where, I mean, he got some applause here and there, but I don't think it was anywhere as charismatic as, like, if Trump did that stuff. And Trump would do that stuff, you know, in back in the previous debates. But yeah, I don't know, DeSantis, man, I don't know. He was just, it was weird. Again, he would pivot, but then I didn't really understand. I mean, I guess we all understood his points, but it was just almost worthless. I mean, there was the leaks of his debate strategy that came out sometime before the debate, and you know, it wasn't very so, you know, everyone kind of came into this expecting him to do that strategy, and he didn't. But honestly, even he should have probably just done the strategy. I mean, like, I don't know what he was trying to do here. His quote-unquote thing is the wokeism stuff, and he didn't, he barely even focused on that. He talked about, like, some whatever the hell that was about the whole abortion story of this lady named Penny in, I think, Texas or whatever. Just, it was like he was super aggressive, like he was super on his feet with, like, countering and sliding by questions. And when you're supposed to do that, I would expect you to come back with, you know, an irrelevant point, but at least a point that you think is strong. But it wasn't even that. It was just dodge, 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 and, you know, don't, you know, pretend I'm not here. Now, he wasn't getting booed as much as some of the other candidates, like Vivek or Chris Christie. So that's why I was a little bit split, because he wasn't, like, you know, he wasn't, you know, attacked by the audience, which is, you know, an audience really represented. I think a lot of them are young, young students or whatnot, obviously with donors too. And it's kind of, you know, representative of, they were young and donors, so it's not fully representative of the base. But you could tell by their boos, they were kind of representative of Trump. And I guess Trump's presence or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I just think, obviously, he, you know, if I think 5 out of 10 is pretty appropriate. Now, for DeSantis as a character, and what he was saying, I mean, obviously, beyond the debate, we know who DeSantis is. I mean, I don't think it's hyperbole at all to call him a fascist. But I think, I don't know, I'm trying to keep it within the confines of the debate. And I just don't think he really, quote unquote, revealed as much. Like, if you're just a, you know, a non-serious voter going in, you're not really going to be persuaded by Ron DeSantis. You know, I mean, I guess the only thing he could say that I think really was jarring enough position-wise, and others agreed with this point, but I think he hammered it a little more, it was like, you know, his, I mean, basically supported, see, not, he wouldn't say it like this, but it was basically putting troops in Mexico, essentially invading Mexico, which is insane. I mean, it's hawkish, it's, you know, it's early in 19th century U.S. presidents, so, I mean, he was, you know, in my eyes, that's the war hawk in him. They're all war hawks, and to some extent, I mean, obviously, Vivek was, seemingly wasn't, but, I mean, at least with Ukraine, but he did say put the troops on the southern border, so it seemed like he was agreeing with, you know, such an invasion of Mexico, which is, I can't even believe we're at this point. They're not saying invasion, but that's exactly what that is. Not like taking over the country of Mexico, obviously, but having military presence, you know, in Mexico, which is, as far as I consider, is an invasion, especially if you're trying to counter, you know, whatever forces. Like, we didn't invade, anyway, but yeah, I don't think he was, revealed too much of his character, but he was, you know, he embodies the fascism that is, and I guess this part does go beyond the debate. I think he does embody the type of fascism where really it's the core of fascism is this, like, world war kind of ideology, this us versus them. I mean, fascism by its very nature is combative. Fascism cannot exist without an enemy. And you will see this again, this ideology, you kind of pioneered, I guess you'd say, by Carl Schmitt, you know, some Nazi lawyer or whatever in the 30s. But you'll see a lot more in Vivek, which I'll come to in a little bit. But this idea of, like, a, you have to create an enemy, even if it's not there. And I think he's done that with, quote-unquote, the woke mob. And he's, I mean, they all do this to a certain extent, obviously. But I think DeSantis has been maybe a bit more like Trump in that respect, where there's, of course, the enemy is always Joe Biden for all of them. The enemy is always the Democrats or whatever. But, you know, kind of having, I don't even want to say a clearly defined enemy, because defining woke is already difficult, Biting DeSantis has kind of, you know, coalesced this campaign, obviously, as that. But again, it's and it's part of the Nazi, you know, that's part of the fascist, you know, strategy is to kind of keep these things vague so you can essentially group more people into it. So he really embodies that kind of fascist strategy. So after DeSantis, I got Mike Pence at 6 out of 10. So this is pretty, actually low-key this most surprising part, well, one of the most surprising parts of the debate in terms of performances. Did not expect him to be that aggressive. He wasn't that aggressive, but he was, Christie and Nikki Haley were obviously super aggressive against Vivek, and especially Mike Pence. He was probably the most aggressive. And I gotta say, he's obviously the, I don't even want to say it, he's the quote-unquote traditional conservative, the neocon, Bolton-esque, Bush-esque, probably worse, actually, to be honest. Obviously, the Christian fundamentalism, it was so present there in this debate, as always with him. I mean, he's obviously an uber-religious guy. Yeah, I mean, his aggression against Vivek was interesting. And, you know, obviously his main points were, you know, you're a rookie. And a lot of them were made at this point. You know, you're a rookie, you're not... you know, you're young, I'm the guy in charge. I've been around here. I've been, you know, around the block. But the interesting thing, this part, I think, was the quintessential part of the debate, and it didn't last long. And it kind of goes into Vivek's, the person that I have next on the list is Vivek at 6.5 out of 10. A lot of people are saying he won this debate. I think partially he did, but I think he really started to get booed, and he just got piled on. And I don't think he did well when he got piled on. When he was making his points, obviously super, super snaky, super politician-y. And again, I'm not even rating these guys on positions. I should clarify. These are just how they did. And he did, like, when he wasn't getting attacked on, I think he did great. I think that's, and he was making the sound bites. I think that's why people have him winning the debate. But there were a lot of good zingers against him. Nikki Haley had zingers, Pence had zingers, Christie had like one or two zingers. He did okay, but I don't think he was the clear winner. But I do want to get to this point, and it's pretty much the main reason why I want to really analyze this debate. There is that section where Vivek talks about U.S. national identity, and where it's quote-unquote meaningless. You know, people are yearning for a national identity. And he says that this sort of identity should come top down. And Pence counters with, no, the American populace already has a national identity. He kind of chalks it up to these good, you know, quote unquote good values. And then Vivek says, he responds with, oh, it's not as shiny as you say. We live in dark times. And Pence counters with, essentially, the government is bad. You know, it's not the people that are bad. So it didn't last long, but I think this is a very clear distinction between those two, and especially a characterization of Vivek. So the idea of national identity is obviously, I think, kind of an understated problem. So I think Vivek is kind of right. But the thing is, in when we talk about national identity, and this gets really, I wouldn't say murky, but really dangerous, well, what else can I say, touchy, in like political philosophy circles, when we talk about national identity. National identity is the reason why it gets kind of dangerous is because it can turn good or bad immediately. This criticism has been made multiple times. There's this guy from Harvard, you know, he's kind of a, you know, whatever, but he makes this point too. And so it's pretty common, it's a pretty common notion that, you know, notions of a national identity, of, you know, unified traditions or whatever, are obviously super important for stability. And I've been kind of realizing that more and more, that this is kind of a very essential part of really society. I mean, obviously, it seems so obvious, but there is the reality that there are notions of losing that, of losing identities. So he made that point. So it's kind of like, you know, I kind of agree, but, you know, obviously I don't really agree on what you think that identity should be. And then he said it should come from the top down. And that was alarming. That sort of ideology, I mean, that sort of position is made by people like Carl Schmitt, is made by, you know, essentially the fascists of old, of a top-down created identity. That's how, you know, racism flourishes. That's how far-right identity politics, flourishes. Is of course, there are other ways they can do these kind of things, but especially when you have identity created, you could say, from the top down. And that was one of the, and that's one of the big problems with American politics throughout its history, is the lack of a coherent national identity. Most, you know, obviously, you know, there are, you know, how should we say, racial identities that are present throughout the world, and that's how national identities in other countries are formulated. But again, as you know, years have progressed, that model has moved on, and even in largely homogenous countries, in places like Norway, with the influx of immigrants or whatever, the idea of what a Norwegian is has obviously evolved beyond just racial, ethnic, national identities, and that's great, honestly. You know, there is some, you'd say, cultural homogeneity, you know, that the immigrants or whatever can go into. But even then, obviously, the way the European, you know, systems work with diversity, it's a lot more, you know, pockets, I would say, at least in my interpretation, just pockets of different cultures rather than a kind of a melting pot that America is. And, you know, that's their own problem. You know, there's good and bad, I guess you'd say, of that. But with America, it's always been a case of finding national identity. And that's, I mean, unfortunately, I don't think that's something that the left has really noticed, I think, as much. I think partially there is, and of course, it doesn't have to be based on racial or even cultural lines with, you know, the American system. I don't really know if I'm essentially, so I think with the American model, I don't know if I'm entirely convinced by it, but I do see its merits with Jürgen Habermas's ideas of political structure. So where essentially there is the reality that there is this sort of dichotomy between traditions that are in place, things that are, you could say, top down, you could say overarching, unifying, maybe totalitarian in nature, not totalitarian, I should say, in the Australian political sense, but totalizing, I could say, you know, ideas of unity, things that bring people together. And there is the, you could say, the more just, you could say, civic, more of the nitty gritty things of government, that usually tend to, you could say, you know, and I was, all, you know, also democratic, you could say, that not necessarily unify people, but, you know, help keep things just. So, for example, we could see, you know, like a pure, you know, political system like fascism is obviously way more so on the one side, where there is this nationalizing identity, system, traditions, race, whatever. And you have some, and you have notions like socialism, even like, you know, just normal democracy, really, that are, which, you know, I don't, I would probably pretty much say is go hand in hand, but obviously that would go one way, at least focus on what, you know, one way, where it's not really, it's, you could say it's more just, but there's less focus on these totalizing identities, which come with their own problems, and vice versa. And, you know, the goal for Habermas was to kind of find the middle ground. And this, I would say, it's kind of already, I think, somewhat, I think it was kind of done. I mean, obviously, I don't think it was consciously done with this in mind, but, you know, the idea is that the identity, the unifying identity, needs to come from these social and civic institutions, you know, in place of race, in place of culture, maybe even of class. You have essentially a unity based off of the institutions that create the just and democratic systems. So unity is based off your political model. I think you did kind of see that with like the Soviet Union. You know, obviously the Soviet Union eventually did have like its own overtly Russian, you know, racism in its own ways, or nationalism in its own ways, that was based off Russian culture or whatever. But I think you did see it there, I think, to a certain extent early on. And I think in the U.S., that's whether consciously or not, whether how much it is or not, that's at least, I think, the model that America is striving for, is in place of race or culture or whatever, the unifying model is this idea of the American political system. But again, whether that comes from the top down or bottom up, inherently, I would think with Habermas's system, it's kind of both. In the way I see it, I might be wrong on this, but you can't impose a national identity, because that's for national identity. A national identity based off of social and civic institutions, it's not as strong as a racial identity, but it's obviously a much safer, right? So national identity. It invites everyone, as long as you're within the political system. And the political system, if just, should already allow for the rights of those of people like that. So that's the idea, at least. So whether it's top down or bottom up, you can't really impose a very loose identity like that, you know, from the top to the bottom. I think it's, the way I see it, it's nurtured inside. I don't think it's bottom up, because obviously social institutions are in top levels of society, or, you know, in the federal government. I think there's a way of mixing and matching, and whether this is Habermas's idea is right or not is irrelevant, because when we go back to the debates, Vivek talking about national identity and being imposed from the top down is inherently fascistic. It's inherently imposing identity from the top to the bottom. And he contradicts this, though. And this is why Vivek is so slimy, because he constantly lies and contradicts himself. And then he had other points. He's like, I want to bring war to the federal government. Then how is national identity being proposed? Is what does the government become? If the federal government, again, if we take everything that Vivek says by word, if it's dismantled, you know, regulations are gone, the Bar of Education is gone, which, again, a lot of them wanted that too. They're bashing our teachers' unions, like, what the hell? Anyway, so by his words, the top is destructuralized. It's done with. But he wouldn't say that about the military. None of them would. I mean, for obviously he didn't say that, because he said move the troops to the southern border. He didn't say, you know, let's not focus on military. He didn't, you know, when he said his anti, when he said, you know, did not send aid to Ukraine, he didn't say let's demilitarize the U.S. No, he was saying let's change focuses. That's it. So obviously his envisioning of what the American government should be is a militaristic, I would assume, and cultural and political entity with, you could say, you know, non-specific opinions really on anything else. That's like the definition of a third party position, a third position, essentially fascism. It's a model of cultural identity or national identity, and obviously militaristic in nature, and it's imposed from the top down. But the top's been destroyed of all these other factors, of these social and civic institutions. They're gone. So what you have left is what's the national identity that's going to be imposed downward? My guess is the conservative model, whatever it is, some sort of fascistic identity, obviously. But the interesting counter was from Pence again, when he said that Americans already have an identity. As dangerous as Pence is, as, you know, fascistic in his own other ways as he is, his counter to that, I think, tells a lot about the difference between him and Vivek, and again, and also of who Vivek is. As crazy as Pence is, his acknowledgement of an identity already present in the American population, again, that could still turn fascistic. You can still have a fascist state that brings up that national identity and impose it, again, top down. But at least with what Mike Pence was saying, with a national identity already present in the population, you know, he attributes these, you know, these good values to them, whatever. It's very different. Essentially, it's, and when he says the government is bad, and what he's saying is actually technically right. It's just, I don't think he's at all intelligent enough or you know, moral enough to really realize how this would work, or he's obviously nefarious and bought out, like all of them. I guess technically not Vivek, but I would still consider him corrupt in other ways. The idea that he said, at least in principle, is, you know, the population already has a national identity. And what that is, he didn't say. It was whether it's the light unity or a specific Judeo-Christian, I don't even say Judeo, because it's obviously, it's Mike Pence, you know, ultra-evangelical identity. It's probably what he means, really. But there is, regardless, there's a national identity already present within the U.S. population, and it's the job of the government to bring that identity up into its, or those values up into its institutions, and essentially be a good government. In principle, fine with that. Again, whatever that national identity is supposed to be, that's the real question. But I think it's a really interesting difference. And I'd probably say a lot of the, I don't think any of them chime into this part, but a lot of the debatees or whatever, I think are debaters. I would probably have the same opinion of, you know, our population isn't crazy. You know, we have this national unifying American tradition, whatever, and is government bad? That's what the Republicans always say, is government bad or whatever. But either way, Vivek's characterization of all of this as, it's just incredibly dangerous about talking about national identities being imposed from the top. And he does have this very contradictory nature with him. And I'm focusing too much on Vivek, but, and obviously other things he said, you know, climate change is a hoax. And I mean, and oh my God. And his, the mere fact that he was like, Trump was the best president of the 21st century. Trump is literally, technically, his political opponent in this race. He is, in principle, running against Trump, but he's not. This was a, the entire debate was a debate for VP. So again, a walking contradiction, and someone like Vivek, who is not intelligent, who is slimy and extremely dangerous, obviously with climate change, and obviously his supporting with you know, war with Mexico, and obviously, you know, and of course the national identity thing, which I think went under the radar, incredibly dangerous, incredibly, it's extremely worrying. So that was my quick analysis of him. So moving beyond him, I do have Chris Christie at 7 out of 10. Chris Christie obviously is his entire campaign is a suicide mission. It's a spear being thrown at Trump. You're going to lose a spear, but you're going to hope it's going to pierce Trump's campaign. Again, whether that's going to work, I don't know. Chris Christie got booed immensely, but Chris Christie has been doing decent in like the New Hampshire polls or whatever. And you know, the way elections work is really, if you have that momentum from the beginning, the hope is you have the momentum going forward. Now, it doesn't always work out. Like for example, with Bernie, I think in really both elections, he started off strong. He starts off super strong. And then you get like Super Tuesday. There's a bunch of Southern states, You're not going to have, you know, essentially the way it works is you start out with very, you could say, liberal states or liberal leaning. You can't even say liberal, but you're not really in the Southern area. You have room for different opinions, I would say. But once you get into Super Tuesday, you're kind of, you have an upward hill to climb. So, but it can work. So Chris Christie, again, I don't think he has any, again, none of these guys have any chance against Trump. It's not going to get that twisted, but, if Christie's name can get name recognition and power, then his attacks may obviously do more along the road. And if death keeps happening, who knows, maybe Trump will return for another debate if he's not in jail. yeah, I mean, Chris Christie, obviously, at policy wise, a horrendous person, super unpopular, the worst. Like every New Jersey hates him, like, corrupt. He's not doing this out of moral reasons, I don't think. In a way, Vivek was right that he's very vengeful. But I think in part, even if he doesn't believe that Trump politically and substantially is bad, you know, he still thinks Trump is a danger to the U.S., which he is. So I get, you know, that all makes sense. But again, yeah, I mean, he hates the teacher, you know, like his anti-union. Yeah, anyway, it's just horrendous politician. But obviously, if I had to vote for someone in the Republican, you know, primaries, I would vote for Chris Christie just as an anti-Trump vote. And it's because I do want him to. And people also don't realize that Chris Christie is basically Trump. He was the Trump of 2016 before Trump. And he demolished Marco Rubio. And to me, a lot of these guys are essentially parallels with the 2016 counterparts. DeSantis is Ted Cruz, in my opinion. He is just as crazy as Trump, but he's number two, and he's seen as the more reasonable one. Marco Rubio, I think draws some parallels with Vivek in terms of like the way they talk. Chris Christie demolished Marco Rubio in 2016. I would hope he kind of did, already in this debate, kind of the Vivek, but it wasn't really demolishing. I think Chris Christie's a little bit, I guess you see, rusty. You know, I think Pence is like the Jeb Bush. You know, he is the traditional, candidate, I guess you say. I guess you could say Haley's Fiorina, but I don't think that's really accurate. Chris Christie is Chris Christie. You know, nothing different there. To with John Casey, I think you gotta make an argument that Chris Christie is like his old self and John Kasich were. Kasich, well, like, you're kind of on your own path. You know, Kasich was anti-Trump. He was kind of seen as reasonable one, even though he's not really reasonable back in 2016. But either way, yeah, Chris Christie was aggressive in 2016, and he still is. And I was happy to see him, even though his performance wasn't as good as 2016. Or 2015, I guess. But he was still there as a weapon. And I think the... he doesn't embody that Northeast type of Republican where he is, you know, the pro-business kind of side of things. But either way, I don't want to say he's irrelevant, but it just depends on how he does, I think, in the beginning of the actual votes. Now, as the winner, I would actually say, having Nikki Haley, which is what a lot of like mainstream media has been saying, and I kind of actually agree with it. Like, I gave her an 8 out of 10. Or Chris Christie's 7 out of 10, she's 8 out of 10. I think she's, you know, she was the quote-unquote moderate on the debate, and I think she actually did pretty well, at least in terms of, like, applauses. Now, whether she's actually going to do well, is it relevant again? I mean, it's irrelevant, but she's not going to do well, obviously, but, you know, and I don't think she, you know, when you make, remarks, you know, of pro-women remarks, that she was making, you know, there's always a question of, is that going to work in the, you know, in the Republican base? And it seemed to, here and there. She didn't, like, hammer it, so I guess I could see why it worked for the audience there, but, I mean, her answers were moderate. It's, you know, it's kind of weird, especially with the abortion issue, like, where you're not agreeing, but you're, like, hoping the sign that says, no, there should be state, it should be left up to the states, and that should be how... you know, it works for banning, you know, for banning abortion. Like, what a weird world we live in. But that's what, you know, she was the one saying that. She was one of the people that were saying that. And she got some applause for that. I think she had the best attacks against Vivek for the Ukraine. Again, regardless of whether you agree with the issue or not, she did her part well. And Vivek really had no response to that. I think overall, I think she came out on top in terms of, like, you know, she wasn't out of the picture like Asa, Burgum, or Tim Scott. She wasn't controversial like Chris Christie, who also got booed, by the way. She wasn't off in her own world like Ron DeSantis as well. And she wasn't, like, she was in matches like Chris Christie, Pence, and Vivek, but she was never really on the losing side. So, like, for example, DeSantis, he was never attacked, but he was never in a fight. Nikki Haley was in fights, or at least a fight, you could say, and she didn't lose. So, again, will her poll numbers go up? Barely, probably. But, you know, at least in terms of winning, that's what that was. And I guess that as closing remarks for what this means, you know, you have all these candidates, and I think they all represent certain different types of candidates, at least for the major ones. You know, you do have, obviously, Nikki Haley's obviously super corrupt, by the way, let's not get that twisted. You do have, I would say, a world war kind of, they're the enemy kind of fascist in DeSantis. You do have, I think, a much more dangerous, legit, I mean, DeSantis is also a legitimate fascist, but I think, I'm talking, like, by the book fascist in Vivek. Like literally by the book. You do have a pragmatic candidate, you could say, like Chris Christie. I lose pragmatic only in the sense that he's anti-Trump. And you have the ultra-conservative like Pence. And they all represent these different types of candidates. The aggression in Christie, the populism, you could say, in Vivek's voice and his remarks. Oh, and one more thing about Vivash before I forget. His notion where he was like, do you want incremental change or revolution? Again, what a contradiction of what the conservative ideology is supposed to be. A conservative, by definition, should be no reform or incremental reform. When he says incremental reform or revolution, the conservative should say, no, the incremental one, that's what I'm down for. But again, the Republican Party has transformed, obviously still conservative, but they're, they're reactionary. And you could say, progress in terms of regress against Biden's policies or whatever. But again, what a walking contradiction. And when you talk about revolution from the right, and actually, funnily enough, Vivek was correct in talking about the American Revolution a lot. Because, people like Edmund Burke have argued that the American Revolution was a conservative revolution, unlike the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, where you're advancing certain institutions or these new ideologies. Although the American Revolution created a new system, I would say created, but it was a Dutch candidate before, a unique system coming out. It was based off of, with the French, it was things are bad and we need to change it. Same with the Russians. With the American Revolution, it was, we have our way of life. It has been, attacked, you'd say. It has been, been bombarded, I guess you say, by the British, arguably. And so we need to return back to what we were. Inherently a conservative revolution. So when he talks about revolution in the context of the American Revolution, I don't know if he was consciously thinking about this. But that's what it is. A revolution is a circle, you could say. He's revolving backwards. And it's an aggressive terminology indicating probably aggressive other, opinions and whatnot. Obviously, climate change. Oh my God, that was insane. But anyway, so Chris Christie's aggression, Vivek's, fake populism, Pence's neocon nature, and DeSantis's, anti-woke. DeSantis has dropped out of the race pretty much. He's kind of like Jeb Bush too. But yeah, and DeSantis is anti-woke kind of stuff. These are all pieces of Voltron that is Trump. Trump has the aggression of Chris Christie, has the fake populism of Vivek, and Vivek is obviously kissing up his ass. The neocon backing of Pence, and obviously the anti-woke stuff that really got him elected in partially in 2016 with DeSantis. And the question is, none of these candidates, you'd say the most valuable part of that is Vivek's fake populism, the most powerful trait, most powerful piece of the Voltron. But the reason why Trump is so crazy of a character is because he embodies all these things. And if you have these things disassembled into multiple candidates, that's what you get. Similarly, in 2020 with Democrats, I wouldn't say in terms of like different personalities, different types of candidates. A big reason why Bernie lost in 2020, in 2016, it's basically proven that the election was rigged against him. The DNC and Hillary were financially like one and the same. In 2020, I don't know if I would go out to say that it was stolen and it was rigged against Bernie, but there were political maneuvers, and the political maneuver was there's too many establishment Democrats, and you need to unify with under one to defeat Bernie, because Bernie was doing amazingly well in the beginning of 2020. I was genuinely convinced that he was going to be president. I was so happy. And then he didn't, and I kind of got tired of politics, but they unified under Joe Biden. Not because each represented something else, but it was because they needed to unify under one specific candidate. With Republicans, I think it's a little bit more, fun to see this. Each candidate is their own part of the piece, their own Infinity Stone in the gauntlet that is Trump. But obviously, with Trump gone, I don't think any of them can really be in place of Trump. And I say this as someone who just obviously doesn't like Trump, but Vivek could say is kind of like him, but he's aggressive like Christie, but I don't think he really has the zingers as much as Chrissy with against other people. I can imagine him getting the neocon backing like Pence and the anti-woke stuff, but his messaging is a little more, you know, base fake populism and national identity bullcrap. Anyway, as my point is that this was a really mid debate. None of them did very well, including Vivek, in my opinion. I think he did better. I think he was third overall, but like if the debate ended like halfway through, I think he would have won. But latter half, he was kind of trailing off a little bit. But either way, each of these candidates are fascists in their own way, and yeah, it's a scary sight. But yeah, anyway, those are my final thoughts, and I'll see everybody on the next episode with my co-host returning, and yeah, we'll see you then.
Oh, to write a song that has no meaning at all, that doesn't touch a personal nerve or heed a social call, that knows no up or down, that has no right or wrong, that doesn't need a reason to waste some time with song, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa whoa whoa. Oh, to sing a song that doesn't let it all hang out, that doesn't wave any flag or have any slogan to shout, that knows no east or west, that has no left or right, that doesn't throw any stones or look for any fight, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa whoa whoa. Just to write a song that won't mend a broken heart, that won't woo you like a lover or promise a brand new start, that doesn't preach of rain and fire or heed any higher call, that doesn't need a reason to mean nothing at all, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba 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 ben, whoa whoa whoa. Just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba 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 ben, whoa whoa whoa. Ba 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 ben, whoa whoa whoa. Ba 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 ben, whoa whoa whoa.